Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, as well as bonus episodes. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
You see, my concern is that neither of them have been heard from since they left this house. And then we got this cryptic text from Jethro. Errol, show him the cryptic text.
Tackle Tommy Woo-Woo.
Is that a religious thing?
I think not.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today?
I'm always trying to tackle Tommy doing the woo-woo. It never works out for me, though.
Indeed. That is, of course, a reference to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about Guy Ritchie's new Netflix series, The Gentlemen, based very loosely off of his film of the same title. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms. We're posting on YouTube. We're posting on TikTok at decodingtv. Also Instagram as well. So be sure to follow us across all platforms there. Today on the podcast, got a couple of TV news items to discuss, specifically the Oscars. And then we're going to dive into episode recaps and reviews of The Gentlemen. The first two episodes of The Gentlemen, the whole series available online on Netflix, as well as Shogun episode 4. We are going to be discussing that, of course, is streaming right now on Hulu and FX. So let's get into it. Shall we, Patrick Klepek? Let's talk about what's happening in the world of television. The Oscars happened this past week. Patrick Klepek, you and I both watched the Oscars. We wanted to talk a little bit about the Oscars as a television product. Now, obviously, Decoding TV, we've not been bullish on the award shows here on Decoding TV.
We have not said
award shows have a bright, long, illustrious future. But I have to say, Patrick Klepek, in terms of how decent an award show could be, how good it could be, yeah, this is a pretty good entry. This year's Oscars were surprisingly not atrocious. And that is saying something for a ceremony that has had its share of slaps and misread envelopes and so on and so forth over the course of the last few years. This Oscars had great films that were given decent, you know, fitting awards and good heartfelt speeches. And it was, I thought, overall, a really well-run telecast that came in under the allotted time. Patrick Klepek, what did you think of the Oscars this year?
Yeah, I had a delightful time watching. We make a whole big production of it with some neighbors of ours who's we're good friends with the parents, and our kids are all best friends. And so we've got, you know, all sorts of games that are going on. Like it's unfair. I pay attention to like the other awards that are happening leading up to the Oscars. And I should just not even compete in the category of picking who's going to win. Because like, well, this is just going to be what the BAFTAs probably were, which I think actually was exactly what the BAFTAs were. So I swept this game against everybody.
Like the awards matched up pretty much 100% or
pretty
very close
100%,
to that.
Right. Yes. So that was unfair on my part. But look, I was the one paying attention. But it was just a perfectly fine, like the Oscars was fairly unique this year in that so many, or at least two of the major films that were up for so many awards were like critically acclaimed and commercially explosive. And that is just rare to get one of those.
It didn't used to be rare. It didn't used to be rare.
Sure. But the habits of the audience have changed. A lot of those types of movies go direct to streaming. And this was like theatrical blockbusters that were beloved by critics and audience goers, drove a ton of money, and crucially had like big stars attached, like big, savvy, like funny, energetic star. It was just a real melting pot that like stirred together really well. And then also it was just a very competently run, entertaining show. It wasn't shockingly fun. I guess it was shockingly fun relative to expectations. But I just had a good time. Like, the hours kind of breezed by. I was just sitting around, you know, filling out forms and drinking beers with a friend, and found myself laughing more often than I expected to. It was really just, I don't know, about as good as you can get for what that show could be these days without reinventing the wheel. I will say there was one, you know, we've talked about before, you know, is the solution, as crass as it is, the sort of game awardsification of these award shows, which is to try and tie up a little more of the forward looking commercial aspect, which would be to include trailers.
Right.
And they did it here without actually doing it. Now, this probably doesn't come across to everybody that isn't paying attention to like the 2024 slate of films, but they were constantly pairing up actors from the upcoming Beetlejuice 2, actors from the upcoming Mad Max film. And the idea that at the end of those award pairings, where they were giving out the awards, they wouldn't go, and stay tuned, like, don't say it in the theater. It doesn't have to like pierce the veil of the Oscars. But for the people watching at home, as they are transitioning out, like, and stay tuned for the first teaser trailer for Beetlejuice 2. Like, why not? Like, it seemed like they set up that opportunity and then just didn't execute it on in a way that I found utterly baffling.
You know, I am having an out-of-body moment right now because I'm now realizing you are exactly correct. That is what they were doing, and I didn't even notice it.
Multiple times, not just once.
It, right? I mean, the one notable one is Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling promoting Fall Guy, which was their new film. But they, I'm going to say that the promotions were so subtle that I think for many people it did not even register. Right?
I had to pick up on it. I thought when I saw Chris Hemsworth, Anya Taylor-Joy came out, I was like, oh, sick! Like, we're gonna get like a
Furiosa. Yeah.
Yes. Like, and oh, like, this makes total sense. And if they say nothing in the actual award ceremony, and it's not as crass as Jeff Keighley being like, awards, what awards? Like, here we have a new world premiere. Like, I was like, this is actually perhaps the most elegant way to do it, is to let the award ceremony be the award ceremony. And then understanding people are at home, they're gonna watch commercials anyway, they're right there. Why not hit them with a trailer that could go viral? Like, the eyes are, it seems so odd to pair up those people to tease upcoming, some of the biggest films of this year, and then not actually cash in on that in a way that means anything other than to me just picking up on patterns.
Well, I don't
like
even
I'm decoding a code.
They didn't even verbalize it, right?
No,
I don't even think they said, you know, the stars of the upcoming Furiosa, the Mad Max saga. They didn't even explicitly say what was going on there.
Bizarre.
I mean, my guess, Patrick Klepek, is it's a whole different other department that handles the ad buys than handles who appears on stage at the Oscars, or maybe that's negotiated completely separately. I believe it was something on the order of $2 million per ad during the Oscars, and that they sold out of the whole inventory or most of it. So probably the level of coordination required for what you're describing was just too much. And it's not like, I think they really try hard not to preference individual studios during the Oscars.
Unlike the Super Bowl, which is just like whoever is hosting that gets just a bunch of free advertising.
Well, they get
for
ads.
Shows.
They get ads for, you know, there's a lot of ABC ads and Disney ads. It was on ABC this year. And so there's a lot of Disney Plus ads for Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour, that's going to be on and Disney Plus and so on. So the company who is running it on their channel gets a lot of ad time that they presumably get at preferential rates or whatever. But I think it's just like really hard to have like a promo for like all these little, there's probably too much bureaucratic red tape of, oh, if we give one to Warner Brothers, we got to give one to Disney. And if we give one to Disney, we got to give one to, you know,
I'm
trying to
it
name all the different studios. There's only like five studios now, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
we're fewer all the time. Baby steps, but it just seemed like they had set up such an obvious and pretty smart way of possibly, like, you know, having their cake and eating it too, which is
right. I agree with you. And by the way, I think they need to be more unabashed about the promotion, because theatrical film going is a declining industry. It's not like a healthy, robust, growing industry. Number of tickets sold continues to go down year over year, you know, like discounting COVID, right? Like, and so it is not thriving. They need to like, hey, put, let's put aside our, you know, how many, how much ad time who can have and be like, we got to make sure people keep going to movies. I completely agree with you, Patrick Lepik. I will mention a couple of other things about The Ceremony I really loved. Ryan Gosling performing I'm Just Ken. Apparently he masterminded all the choreography for that.
Incredible.
According to the PR, it was an exuberant,
please don't
wonderful,
get canceled. Stay beautiful. Stay beautiful. Yeah. You're one of my favorite like working actors today. So charming. Like, don't be bad. Don't be bad.
Yeah. What a joyful celebration of song and film. I just thought that was like a real highlight for me. Christopher Nolan winning Best Director. I have so much respect and admiration for what he has done. I don't love all of his movies. I think Tenet, for you know, Tenet has spectacular moments. Pretty bad film, in my opinion. But there's many movies he's made that are probably in my top 10 of all time, and he has done so much to keep the dream of adult-oriented big-budget blockbusters alive. And so I think he totally deserves it. Seeing Anatomy of a Fall get some love was great. That is a brilliant film. Have you seen that yet, Patrick Lepik?
Yeah, no, my wife and I make a real point leading up to the Oscars. We try and watch all the Best Picture nominees leading up. We watched everything but American Fiction. It's the only one that slipped through the cracks. But yeah, Anatomy of a Fall was one of my favorite films from last year, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, and also, I also just wanted to highlight the visual. Godzilla Minus One was nominated for one Academy Award. Best visual effects, and they won that award.
So cute. So
and they
cute.
Were so cute because they were geek. They were clearly nerds and geeks just geeking out about the fact that they're in the room with Steven Spielberg and all these other stars. They did not expect they would win. And the director, who is also on the visual effects team, which is relatively rare. And so he gave the speech, and it's just, it was delightful. It was delightful to see them geeking out about it. And it's actually kind of rare. You know, I realize it's kind of rare to see somebody that's just a big fan of the thing they made expressing their fandom of the thing they made at the Oscars. You know, there's no, like when Cillian Murphy, he doesn't come to the Oscars like dressed like Oppenheimer. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make any sense. But
well, it makes so much sense if you've seen Godzilla Minus One, because I mean, that film is uniquely its own thing, but also deeply, deeply indebted to a certain type of Hollywood blockbuster, specifically of the Spielbergian kind. Like that movie has direct references, homages, riffs on Jurassic Park, Jaws. And so it does not shock me for him to feel such reverence in that moment, to be feet away from a filmmaker who, like, Godzilla Minus One doesn't exist in the form that it is in now without like the influence of Spielberg. And that's like so wonderful to see for someone like that to have a moment where they get to share that kind of awe, because that's, you know, that doesn't happen as, you know, you get an Emma Stone on stage where she's clearly taken aback, did not seem prepared to win that Oscar, but that's a different sort of awe that we're talking about than the one that the director of Godzilla Minus One was. That was just a genuine, like, oh my God, like, I cannot believe I'm here in the presence of people who I consider like cinematic gods to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a wonderful moment. Also, somebody pointed out, is this the first time that a movie and its sequel have both won Oscars in the same year? Referring, of course, to Oppenheimer and Godzilla by this one.
Very good.
Also, Patrick Lepik, this is a callback to our earlier work here on Decoding TV, but look, Emma Stone, one of the most brilliant actors working today. I actually think I'm one of the few people that thinks her winning was extremely well deserved. A lot of people are rooting for Lily Gladstone. I think Lily Gladstone did an amazing job in Killers of the Flower Moon. In my opinion, she was ill served by the script of that film.
She was really good in a, I thought, fairly mediocre film, all told.
Her character in the latter half of that movie, in my opinion, is a mess. Like, just from a writing perspective, not from the performance perspective. So I feel it's a very reasonable win. At the same time, the speech that she gave which, as Patrick indicates, is as far as we can tell, she did not expect to win. There was a report that somebody talked to her before the ceremony, and she's like, "Oh, I'm not going to win." Like she really, whether she was psyching herself up to lose or whatever, like she did not seem like she expected to win. She was, she seemed genuinely shocked. At the same time, as all that is true, everything I've just said is true. The speech that she gave is very similar to the speech that Whitney from The Curse would have given in that situation.
That's just the level of commitment that we are getting from her these days, David. That is just a compliment to her talents.
For those who don't know, she plays this character called Whitney in The Curse, who's kind of an oblivious, white, liberal, like rich liberal feminist
my
type.
Dress and, don't look at my dress,
right but also like I share this with you. I share this award with you. It's like
that is one of those again, that is a well-meaning
it's a perfect Whitney saying,
is, because it's like everything, you know, I don't know Emma Stone, but everything that we can project on her as being outside observer seems like a genuinely good,
yes,
empathetic, nice person. And you arrive at saying that there were people doing like forensic analysis of her reaction as it was announced. And a lot of it was so funny because it was like the moment she realizes she's about to produce an enormous discourse about stealing an Oscar from Lily Gladstone. And it's like, I don't know if that was zapping through her synapses as that was happening, but her reaction made it plausible that she at least was smart enough to know, like, uh-oh, I got to acknowledge this somehow. And that comes out in a very kind of fumbled, if well-meaning, fashion. But you're right, that is a very Whitneyism sort of way to handle, is it?
Any other moments you want to mention from the Oscars that you want to highlight, Patrick Klepek?
Yeah, it wasn't always perfect, but I found the bringing out previous winners to acknowledge the nominees to be very, like, at its best was extremely touching when you could tell the people were heartfelt, weren't looking at a prompter. You know, we're just speaking to these people, and that didn't always line up, but I loved the idea. Like I thought that was a smart, interesting way to acknowledge the history of a category and the kind of passing of a torch that is often associated with like the ongoing process of acting and awarding new performances. And so didn't always, each of those didn't land. Some of them felt like, that's why I mentioned the prompter. I felt like when I saw prompter look, that was, I don't know what I'm like. I don't have the heartfelt moment to share here. I'm sharing what was written, but I liked the idea. And between moments like that, pairing up presenters so that the show was always just moving along. There was less downtime.
What they did was they had presenters present two awards in a row, and that really helped move the thing along. It's shocking how much time goes into those transitions, basically, right?
There was, you know, how much of the writing was like a writing staff was like good bits, like the Kate McKinnon Jurassic Park bit fucking killed me. I mean, I was dying.
Wow.
I thought there were some legitimately good bits in the show. Again, part of it's relative to expectations, but if that's if that's the foundation for the future, I think they can produce some decently strong shows. The question is going to be, how often are you going to have a Barbie and an Oppenheimer? How often are you going to have a Ryan Gosling doing a I'm Just Ken? Like, there was a certain, it's possible this show was a bit of a mirage, because I don't know these ingredients are going to exist
right.
every year, which is why the lack of the trailer placement in a way that made sense and didn't interrupt the ceremony and make it feel especially crass. I look at that as a missed opportunity, because you should be laying the groundwork for how are more people going to tune in the future if you don't have, you know, Ryan Gosling doing this like incredible singular performance from Barbie. So that would be some of my worry going forward for the show.
Well, we got amazing musical numbers. We got movies that made billions of dollars at the box office that people had seen before. We had a relatively entertaining show. So you'd think, wow, the ratings must be huge compared to last year. And the answer to that, the actuality is not really. 19.5 million viewers, according to Nielsen. I'm reading from the Washington Post here. That is not bad at all. Like, that's very solid. But it is only a 4% increase from last year. Now, if you'll recall, last year was the year where Everything Everywhere All at Once swept many of the categories. And I will say I predicted that the bump would be a little bit bigger this year between Barbie and Oppenheimer, considering, you know,
it's just linear, right? Like, by linear, yeah. I mean, like, this is what people are watching on, like, you know, standard television sets. It's right. Interesting.
Millions of people have seen the clips of, you know, so that's from the Oscars, right?
I do think on some level, like, you'll notice this when Jeff Keighley, who runs the Game Awards, when he talks about the metrics of the show, and that show is simulcast everywhere. You can watch it on Steam, Xbox, PlayStation, YouTube, Twitch. Basically, the idea is we just want you to watch so we can add up all of those numbers together. Yeah. And then those numbers at the end, it's difficult to parse what they mean, but it's like, it's huge. Like, it's an enormous number. And at some level, and I think this part of this is a product of how we've discussed before, like, does it make sense to take this off of a network show, put it up on YouTube or something? Is there a solution that makes a little more sense? I just think looking at the Oscars, these moments, things like I'm Just Ken, singularly in who watched it live when it occurred, does not reflect the landscape in which how people consume and enjoy this stuff. I had friends who were not watching the show live. They were just like playing a game and then reloading the YouTube channel as the awards were, they were being uploaded basically in real time to like different channels. So you didn't have to be watching it alongside. And so it kind of betrays what is the actual reach of that show and reinforces in some ways a like negative perception of a show that has lots of problems, but viewing it strictly as who is watching it on a television set, I don't think is necessarily the best judge of whether it's been a success. And so I think those numbers can be kind of misleading and a punching bag that kind of betrays a little bit of the actual reach of some of what they put together.
Totally fair. But also it is a good way of comparing how it's done to previous years.
Sure.
Because absolutely, we have those consistently over, we have that number consistently over time. By the way, at its worst, 2021, during the pandemic, when no one was going to movies, that was 9.85 million total viewers. So that was like the nadir of the show.
And we're home. And we got a lot of people have nothing better to do and still said, I'm not watching the Oscars.
Yeah. So last year was like 18.7 million. This year, 19.5 million. It's a little bit of a bump. And you're right. A lot of people are experiencing it in other ways. It's like Seth Meyers, right? His clips on YouTube get millions of views, way more on YouTube than do watch it linearly. So I think that's worth highlighting. A bit of a mixed bag. On one hand, 19.5 million. Still pretty good in today's day and age. On the other hand, as we've said copious times here on the podcast, not necessarily a type of television product that has a super bright future.
Yeah.
It's not a thing. I don't think it's going to be 25 million next year. You know, I think they're in the process of managing decline as opposed to managing growth right now.
I agree. So,
yeah. Anyway, those are some thoughts on the Oscars this year, both what happened there as well as a television product.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
All right, Patrick Klepek, quick story here that I thought was kind of interesting, which is, first of all, something that we may have mentioned on this podcast is that they are rebooting the original X-Men cartoon animated show.
I think reboot is actually not the correct term. I think it's a direct sequel to the original series.
Wow. Questioning my terminology. Is it a... I think
that's right, though.
I think actually requel is the technical term.
Okay.
Actually, no. I think you're probably right. I think it's just literally a sequel. I mean,
X-Men 97 continues the story of X-Men the animated series.
Yeah, yeah. It continues where it left off. Yeah. So technically sequel is right, but it is also something that, as far as we can tell, is trying to capture the original tone and style of the original, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 97 is there on purpose so that if your kids come across it and go, this isn't what cartoons look like anymore, it's on purpose.
Yeah. And I just, before we talk about this news, which is that the creator of X-Men 97 has been fired from the show weeks before its premiere, I thought we could just take 1 minute to talk briefly about our thoughts on the X-Men franchise, and particularly that show. I will say that it was a huge part of my childhood. And I remember joyfully, I think it was like Saturday morning cartoons, right? Mm-hmm. You'd wake up on Saturday morning and watch TV, and it would be on Fox, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
And
yep.
And it had the most badass theme song of any animated show ever. And I'll play, this is from the trailer. I'm going to play it for the trailer of X-Men 97, which does a kind of reorchestration of that theme song. Here it is.
We get this done by working together as a team.
Jeez, Bob. Keep buzzing in my ear.
I mean, that gives me the feels listening to that, right?
It goes hard. It still goes hard.
It still goes hard. It's still good. It's classic. And I, you know, it was a really great way to experience these superheroes, to be introduced to their storylines. And it's kind of interesting how, in some ways, it was in dialogue with the Bryan Singer X-Men film that came out later on. You know, like, that was a much more serious version of what these superheroes could be. And it's just kind of, it was a seminal entry into superhero like intellectual property as we experience it as kids. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on that X-Men animated series?
Yeah, it's long. You know, I was, you know, 97. Is 97 when it ended, or 92 to 97? And so, I mean, I, you know, 92 would be, you know, me you know, me being as young as seven for watching that show, the age that my oldest daughter is now. So I don't have specific memories of arcs, but I do know that I attribute the X-Men, even though I didn't know it at the time, as sort of like, that was my first introduction to comic book characters. Yeah. I didn't understand them as comics. I didn't understand like what exactly I was watching, because that was sort of, for people that don't, you know, are younger, like, we call it Saturday morning cartoons because it was a dedicated block of shows that like parents could kind of plan around, where it's like, hey, like, you're up, you put the kid in front of the TV with their food. I mean, it's in the same way that, you know, I use an iPad skillfully to sort of like accomplish like making dinner. And it's like my kids can be engaged with something while I do that. A Saturday morning cartoon block like functioned the same way when you did not have on-demand programming. And X-Men sticks out. Like, the legacy in my mind is the theme song, just like, because as we said, it goes so hard that it just sits with you for so long. But I think part of what I really appreciated about that show that I couldn't fully articulate at the time was just like how endearing and cool these characters were, and to just have that in the mix with like whatever six other shows, you know, I was watching that morning. I mean, I directly attribute things like the X-Men to being interested in, then like Power Rangers, like the entire idea of like a squad team ups.
Yeah.
Often what you're watching is singular characters,
right,
or like
Spider-Man
small
or something.
Yeah, like, you're,
right.
Like, but the idea of like a whole squad of interesting, well-developed characters. I wouldn't be shocked if X-Men was sort of my first introduction to that as a kid.
They all have these distinct powers, these distinct looks, these distinct personalities. They kind of bounce off each other in interesting ways. Remember, like, the Sentinels
and
massive robots and how they were designed, which is, like, so different, again, than how they were in X-Men Days of Future Past. Like, both of them are cool designs, but just iconic designs. Like, just bringing the comics to life in such a vivid way.
Well, and then led to one of my all-time favorite video games, like the X-Men arcade game, which was this giant, this like just enormous footprint of a video game that was famous at the time for like how big the controller panel was in order to fit. I think actually you could play six people at once in that. It was unique in that it wasn't two or four, but I think you could have up to six characters because there were different forms of this arcade machine, but the one that I always remember at my local arcade had just like this enormous widescreen. Like it was just so much bigger than anything else. And so there's like a direct line between the popularity of that video game with the popularity of that cartoon series and the popularity of arcades, you know, in like the social fabric at the time. Because I directly remember like wanting to play that game. Because like, oh man, like Nightcrawler is sick in like the cartoon show.
Do you have a favorite character? First of all, the cabinets I'm seeing online right now, Patrick, are mostly four player cabinets. So, but maybe your arcade had a special one because they also do not look particularly widescreen as well. But did you have a favorite character you played in that game? I think like for me, it was always Wolverine. He was the coolest, right?
Yes. I can send you a link. David Chen, there is a unique six player X-Men the arcade game machine. But yes, a lot of the ones. Well, I don't know if you can buy that these days. Like the arcade one up ones are, which are like they kind of the kind of arcade machines you can buy for a decent price these days.
I'm seeing this now. Yeah, if you search X-Men arcade six player cabinet, you'll see.
Yeah, you'll get that. You'll get that big boy. You'll get that. It was so cool. It was. It was like legitimately a mon. Like you're walking in front of a monolith in the arcade. It was so incredible. Much fun. Nightcrawler. I found myself like really attracted just because he was so quick.
Yeah,
and nimble. Yeah. But you know, the boring answer of watching the show is that, like, of course, I thought Wolverine was a badass because, I mean, knives came out of his hand. What do you want me to do? I was a 7-year-old boy.
There's this amazing moment in the trailer where Gambit gets on Wolverine's back and like and it energizes his claws. Mm-hmm. So badass. Anyway, okay, so X-Men 97, right? New TV show that's going to be premiering on Disney Plus. March 20th, so within a week of when you're listening to this right now, creator of the show, Bo DeMeo, I'm reading here from Hollywood Reporter, he is in the middle of promoting this show. He is previously Marvel regular who wrote on live-action series such as Moon Knight and as well as the Blade movie. And he had apparently finished writing season 2 of X-Men 97. And he was about to attend the premiere when all of a sudden, Marvel and DeMeo suddenly parted ways early last week. His company email was deactivated, and cast and crew were informed he was no longer the project. Let me end quote right there and say, that's not uncommon for people to drift in and out of Marvel projects. Like, this is a very, if you look at Echo, some of those episodes had like 8 writers or 6 writers on them. It's like it's very common for people to have control of a franchise and not have control of it anymore and so on and so forth. But I will say what is rare are, number one, that it's happening so close to the premiere that they're taking this guy out and firing him. And the other thing is, quoting here from the article, DeMeo's Instagram account, once a source for X-Men updates, was deleted. No reason for the firing was given, end quote. That is much more rare when somebody deletes a vast swath of their social presence. It does make it seem like there is some other part of the story that's going to come out at some point. Maybe by the time you're listening to this, it'll have come out of what actually went down here, because people don't usually delete their entire Instagram accounts when they move off of a Marvel project. Anyway, I don't want to speculate too much about what happened here because we don't know anything. But Patrick Klepek, I'm curious, what was your reaction to the story?
Yeah, you can't help but wonder that there's some other shoe to drop, and you know, you don't want to speculate necessarily on what it could or couldn't be, because you know, you don't want to accidentally slander someone if it's a more complicated nuanced situation, as it often can be. But on its face, yes, like you're right, that it is very normal on lots of big, look at how much trouble Star Wars has had, like keeping creatives, even after they announced or even after they go into production on films. It is fairly normal these days on these massive $100 million scale or even just franchise projects for there to be a lot of push and pull with the rights holders and the people steering those creative visions on a much higher level. But you're right. It is much, much different for it to happen on the eve of the press tour. It was also mentioned in the article, not only was the second season written, they were beginning to like hammer out like what a possible third season would be. So you have a creative that clearly they believed in, clearly like allowed them to shape a huge amount of an important show for Disney, especially in a year where there won't be a ton of Marvel projects. And this one has a lot of millennial nostalgia tied up in it where, you know, if it hits, I could see it hitting pretty well for that audience in particular. The deleting of social accounts is, that makes you wonder, again, you can't speculate on the what, but that something else is on the horizon, because that goes a little further than what is it usually called, creative differences, as is often said when people part for any number of reasons that they don't want to explain. But I hope the show is good. You know, I've been enjoying the fact that the way they've talked about this show is recognizing a lot of the parallels that people see in the X-Men as like a metaphor for marginalized folks, and doubling down on that idea in this version of the X-Men in terms of how they've treated certain characters, like added a non-binary character to the lineup. And that's exciting. Like, that's cool. That's an interesting way to continue the legacy of like the X-Men as a franchise and how it's always been interpreted. And like to end up here is a, it's, you know, at the end, it's like, without knowing what happened, it's a bummer, because if you want creatives to be able to, you know, bask in and enjoy like the celebration of their work if people end up liking it. And without knowing what happened here, it's like that this stinks for all the people involved, all the voice actors, all the animators, that what are they getting questions about right now?
Right.
What happened to the showrunner? Like, what are we waiting to hear about? And that's unfortunate for a show that seems like it might end up being pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. I should point out that in May of 2023, Bo DeMeo had already announced he'd be deleting his Twitter account, apparently after he was attacked by users accusing X-Men 97 of whitewashing the character of Sunspot with the casting of a Brazilian actor in the role. So that it was already something that he had already stepped away from for, I'm sure, what was a very challenging situation back then. But the new thing is Instagram. And he had deleted his Instagram page. Apparently, he had been responding to people, you know, giving people previews of the X-Men stuff and talking about it. And who knows why that happened. The other thing I do want to mention also is, man, Kevin Feige is not having a good time right now, is my guess, right? Between all the stuff that's happened. Can you imagine all the stuff that's happened the last year? Secret Invasion, the Marvels tanking horribly, Jonathan Majors, now this. It is,
I mean, even COVID itself seemed to throw the entire COVID plus Disney plus seemed to, that alone threw Marvel into an extreme disarray coming off of Endgame. It has been a, however you think of Feige and how he's handled all of that, I think you can say he's been handed some difficult cards unrelated to the cards he's played himself.
Indeed. So we will see how this show plays out, and you know, it'll be debuting next week. Maybe we'll share some thoughts on this podcast at some point.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a main show that we'll cover, but it might be something that we talk about. So anyway, we'll see what happens when X-Men 97 premieres. And but wanted to mention this story about Bo DeMeo being fired by Marvel just weeks before the premiere of X-Men 97. That's a few of the pieces of TV news that have been going on this week. All right, Patrick Klepek, let's get to the TV episodes we're going to be discussing and reviewing and recapping today. Today, we're going to be discussing The Gentlemen episodes 1 and 2 on Netflix, and also Shogun episode 4. Next week, we'll be continuing our coverage of Shogun. We'll be doing episode 5 next week. Also, we'll be covering Manhunt on Apple TV Plus. First two episodes will be debuting, probably as you're listening to this, they'll be live. So Manhunt and Shogun will be what we'll be covering next week. And also, yeah, we will also be covering the rest of the Gentlemen at some point later on, probably in the next month or so, as a bonus episode. So I do want to let people know they can look forward to that. And finally, one other piece of announcements, I guess. Patrick will not be on the podcast next week. Patrick, you're going to be doing a you'll be on vacation, I believe. Is that right? Or
I am. I'm taking the kids to Disneyland by the. Well, even when this comes out, my kids still won't know that they're going. They know that we're going to California to meet up with their mom, who's out doing a work convention.
You better
out
hope
there.
They don't listen to Decoding TV, Patrick Puppet, or else.
Well, I was proven. My oldest could handle it. My youngest cannot. We waited to tell my youngest that right before my wife left, like, hey, you know, I know you're sad that mom's leaving, but you know, you're gonna have fun with dad, and in a week we're gonna go meet her on an airplane. And she goes, tomorrow? Like, no, I know you don't understand time. You're four. No, and like, you're gonna sleep a couple nights and then wake up and we'll go on a plane. Tomorrow? I'm like, no, not tomorrow. And then she had a tantrum on the floor. I was like, this is why you don't know we're going to Disney. I'm gonna tell you you're going to Disney the day before we go to Disney.
Right. Absolutely. Good move there. Anyway, so to recap, it's going to be Gentlemen this week and Shogun this week, Manhunt and Shogun next week, and also at some point later, we'll be covering the Gentlemen the entire season. So let's get into it, Patrick Klepek. Let's talk about the Gentlemen on Netflix.
I didn't ask for any of this. The title has no practical value. The business is broken. There are holes in the roof. The staff are revolting, and you, brother, are a coke-sniffing cunt.
Allow me to introduce myself. I used to be in business with your father. I have certain interests I need to discuss with you.
Now, what happens down there?
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about The Gentlemen on Netflix. Here is the premise of the first episode. When the Duke of Halstead dies, his second son inherits everything, including the title, house, and grounds, plus a whole heap of trouble, end quote. Patrick Klepek, in one sentence or less, do you think people should watch The Gentlemen?
I was tickled by this show. I know more of Guy Ritchie through cultural osmosis than actively keeping up with his career, and so maybe more of his creative tics work on me because I've been less exposed to them over the course of his filmography. But I had a great time with the first couple episodes and am anxious to see how the rest plays out.
I also really enjoyed this. If you like Guy Ritchie's British gangster movies, I think you're going to like this show as well. I kind of often measure how much I like a show like this by how eager I am to get back to it after you and I talk about it on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I found myself feeling very constrained by the fact that we only talk about the first two episodes, right? We want to just talk about the beginning and the end. And I can't wait to get back. Like, I wanted to watch more episodes before we started recording today. And so that gives you an indication of how much I enjoyed it. So it sounds like for Patrick and I, this one is a hit. So check it out on Netflix. Patrick Klepek, let's now talk about and spoil the plot of the first two episodes of The Gentlemen. So all eight episodes are live. Patrick and I have seen the first two. The first two episodes revolve around Eddie Horniman, who is minding his own business as a UN peacekeeper, when all of a sudden he's called back home. Let's pause here for a second. I just love that they chose kind of like one of the most noble professions, I guess you could have, arguably, you know, depending on what your thoughts are.
Sure.
But it's kind of like this is kind of like a bleeding heart for the world, basically.
Well, and even how he's portrayed in that brief moment is like, hey, we've got our rules, but, you know, like there's a sequence where somebody, their papers were expired, and he's like, they're 3 days expired. Just tell him to get them fixed before he comes across the border again. And it's like,
he's an understanding, kind chap, you know?
Yeah.
He's a nice dude. And so, but it's funny, basically you choose to, it's almost like they're like, okay, head of a London crime family syndicate-ish thing. What is the most opposite profession we can have of that? And I guess they settled on UN peacekeeper. Right?
Well, and also, I think interestingly, before we know, you know, I knew very little about this show ahead of time, so this maybe more of this came as a surprise to me as the show went along. But we don't even know he's rich, right? Like, nothing about somebody who's doing this job as it's portrayed. It suggests like It's probably a good job. It probably like lets you pay your bills.
Right.
But nothing that is extravagant or lavish. And
that
so,
he's like royalty or he has titles or whatever. You would not suspect that, right?
So I think it does a pretty good job of establishing the moral center of a character in a very brief amount of time. I mean, this sequence lasts minutes before we then realize that, like, oh, you're about to be whisked away into riches. But it's I thought that was very effective at setting up an interesting arc for a character that we know, if you're watching a show like this, like, we know where this is headed. Like, none of that's going to be a surprise.
Eddie is shocked to learn that he is the new Duke of Halstead after the passing of his father and has inherited his entire estate. Unfortunately, his brother Freddy thinks the throne belongs to him, and also Freddy's just generally not very bright and has already gotten himself into a lot of trouble. In fact, he owes $8 million to Tommy Dixon, who's the brother of... Oh, I messed up this name. What's the guy's name? Gospel?
Gospel's the other one, right? No.
He's the brother of the Gospel.
Of the Gospel, yes.
Yeah. But anyway... who's the head of the Scouse crime family. So anyway, he owes $8 million to this other crime family, and they are coming to collect very soon. So Freddie meets Susie Glass, who helps her father, Bobby, run a massive weed-dealing operation right out of Eddie's estate, which, by the way, is an estate that's of great interest to Stanley Johnston with a T, played by Giancarlo Esposito, who wants to buy it and potentially move into the meth dealing business. The first two episodes focus on Eddie's attempt to pay off Freddie's debt to Tommy, but things go horribly awry when Freddie ends up murdering Tommy while he's in a chicken suit. So that's basically the plot of the first couple episodes is how they get out of this situation. And let's start with this. Like many of Guy Ritchie's movies, these episodes create a whole world of colorful characters and a tone that's irreverent, but also occasionally grotesquely violent. How did the tone of the show work for you, Patrick Levick?
I thought that worked. I thought that worked really, really well. I think a lot of that is owed to Kaia Scodaro, who plays Susie Glass. I think she is the heart of this show. Her performance is captivating, and I think she represents like some of the best ways this show oscillates between not quite deadly serious, but like deeply funny, and also I think her performance is magnetic, and is like she's the kind of act like performance where every time she's not on screen, I'm wondering. I think she should be on screen again.
She kind of exudes this hyper competence.
Yes,
I don't know that I would say she's the heart of the show, but I love her performance in the show, and she is extremely compelling. But she's kind of like, this is a person who's extremely familiar with the world, who understands all the rules, and who's going to like keep things moving along.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're really meant to empathize with Theo James, who plays Eddie. And I don't know that I find that character particularly interesting at this point in time. You know,
I guess that's part of the reason why I'm so drawn to the Susie Glass character is because he's fine. You know what I mean? Like he's fine.
He certainly looks the part. Very, very handsome fellow.
He looks the
part,
and I don't know if it's the writing. I can't tell if it's the acting, but there's something, it all doesn't come together. I guess I don't really buy it is part of what I'm having trouble with. Like, I like the world. I like the characters, I like how they're meshing together as a whole, but the one worry I have about the show going forward is if so much ends up hinging on him, that's going to be a problem for me because he's fine for me as a cog in the broader machine that is the show and its storytelling. But I don't know. There's just something about that character, that performance that I don't know. I have trouble fully buying. Maybe it's because he's like almost less cartoonish than everything else around him. Susie Glass is kind of like the straight character who is like the kind of like in some ways like an audience guide to like what's happening in the world, what are the rules, like who are the players, everything around him is so exaggerated and he is so straight, like I'm cool as a cucumber, but then occasionally I kill a guy, sort of thing. And I guess maybe that actually, as he loosens up as it goes along and probably embraces being, you know, a member of a criminal enterprise and probably kills a lot more people along the way, maybe that will blossom into something, but there's something about the kind of blandness of the character.
Yeah.
I think purposely as written, I have trouble putting it on the performance. I think this is more of, this is the character as it's on the page. I have trouble buying that, and I'm hoping it'll be more dynamic and interesting as the show goes along.
I agree. I think he makes the transition really quickly from UN peacekeeper to I'm the new Duke of Halstead. And there's no, you know, I don't need a show that's full of him being like, wow, I can't believe our family's doing all these horrible things. That's unbelievable. Like, I don't need like a show full of that, but I want kind of a teensy tiny bit of that to show like, hey, maybe this role doesn't fit completely like a glove, because that would be boring, which it kind of is a little bit. You know,
he's a little too calm and
witnessing all this wild stuff happening, and he's just like, "Oh, that's cool. I understand all this." And it's like, you know, he's pulling off that character well, if that's what the character's supposed to be, but that's not a particularly interesting character. You know, it's just like, oh, a person who's completely in control of everything. Okay, great, I guess.
Right, and that makes sense for like the Susie Glass character, because this is someone who's seen all this shit before.
Yes,
and
yes.
Like, okay, we got to get rid of a body. Here's how we get rid of a body. And so I don't need him to be losing it, because his brother is already kind of playing a wild card character. But I do miss a little bit of the... I need like an arc. I need you to be like a little weirded out. There's just something a little bit more to the transition, because it seems like we've just immediately gone to, well, this is a complicated situation, but I have some ideas on how to solve it. It's like, you do? Why? Why do you have ideas on how to solve it? It just seems like we jumped to that, what is it, Arrested Development, the jump to conclusions, Matt? Like, I feel like he's jumped ahead a couple character arcs in the show. It's in a way
office
that...
Space.
Office Space. Yes.
One of the things that is kind of one of Guy Ritchie's tics that I mostly appreciate is
okay.
He likes playing around with time a lot. He will often have a character say something, and then he'll cut to the moment in time when that was relevant, you know, back in like 3 hours ago or an episode ago or whatever. And I do think we get a lot of that in the first couple episodes. For instance, the end of the first episode is, in my opinion, a great sequence where you feel this thing escalating, you know something terrible is about to happen, and then what ends up happening is Freddy ends up killing the person he owes a debt to, Tommy Dixon, who, by the way, his brother, Tommy Dixon's brother, is John Dixon. So John the Gospel Dixon, which I love John the Gospel Dixon's intro of he's reading Bible verses while he's suffocating people to death. It's just like so delightfully over the top and very classic Guy Ritchie. Then in episode 2, they replay that entire sequence back from the perspective of another character, which I just really thought was like a cool way of of recapping what had happened, but in a really interesting, with a different filmmaking style. Anyway, so... I kind of appreciate Guy Ritchie's stylistic touches in these first couple of episodes. The other thing I want to mention is just Dar Salim is an actor that plays a character named Felix, whose job it is to clean up dead bodies. And also he has strong opinions about how you should handle these situations, like no witnesses and so on and so forth. Dar Salim, awesome actor. He was in Guy Ritchie's movie called The Covenant, which very few people saw, but he was amazing in that movie too, and I really enjoyed that film. But I thought he was wonderful in this show, and also he puts a great button on the second episode, right? The whole time, Eddie Horniman is trying to prevent this kid, Jethro, from getting killed, because Jethro has witnessed something horrible happening, which is Tommy Dixon, you know, Tommy Dixon's dead body on the estate. And so Eddie spent all this time dedicated to trying to save Jethro's life. And then there's this wonderful moment when Eddie's talking with Susie while they're sending Jethro off. He's like, you know what? I think we're not going to see him again. And Susie's like, you know what? I have a feeling you're right about that. And I was like, wow, that's odd. That's an odd thing for Susie to say. You know, why would she say that? That's weird. That's very un-Susie-like. And then later you find out it's because she has engineered Jethro's death at the hands of Felix right at the end.
Poor
kid. Yeah. Wonderful moment, and kind of this sign that, hey, Eddie is in a world that he's not really, he doesn't really understand yet.
Right? Yeah.
That was a cool moment of that. Yeah. But any thoughts on Dar Salim playing Felix or any of the characters that aren't Susie Glass in the show?
No, he's especially great because the introduction we get to him is so great because they call him to come clean up a mess and he's clearly just blasted at the bar.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful Go ahead.
It seems early in the it's before lunch. I guess the sense that I'm getting, and like him sleeping off, being drunk in the car, and then being upset. There's a small kicker of a joke there where he, you know, doing the common thing that doesn't work as well as it's portrayed in the movies, which is like, I'm drunk, I'll just have some coffee and that'll fix me right up, get an upper with a downer. That's not quite how body chemistry works necessarily. But he asks for a coffee, falls asleep in this car, shows up to take care of a body, wakes up, feels refreshed, and he's like, give me my coffee. It's cold. It's like, yeah, because you were asleep for the last hour and change or whatever as you got out to this estate. Just a really wonderful performance that we get just kind of bits of in the first two episodes, and I'm hoping that'll be an expanded role, as I feel it would be a waste to just have him be a bit player and I'm hoping that there'll be more of him. But I mean, I think
it's just funny to have someone put together the ingredients for disposing of bodies while completely out of it, because almost all the time in those movies like John Wick or Pulp Fiction, the people that come to clean up the bodies are hyper competent. And then you kind of realize, oh, like, if your job is just to clean up bodies, maybe you're kind of like the B team. Like, maybe in the hierarchy of the criminal underworld, you're not actually doing that well, because if you were doing better, you wouldn't just be cleaning up the bodies, you know? So maybe his life is not going exactly as he'd like. I like that idea. And it was brought to life wonderfully in the show. So,
and I don't mind Freddie, but the one pause I have about where the rest of the show might go is, I think it would get very tiring if the entire dynamic of the show then becomes Eddie cleaning up, Freddie making another stupid decision.
I was already annoyed by the end of episode one, you know, that we're dedicating this amount of resources to it, right?
Because there's like nothing redeeming about Freddie. Like, we are not given a lot of insight into they don't seem to be particularly close brothers, other than the fact that family, you know, family's blood, and that, like, you might be close, like, but there's nothing about this family that, like, screams they love to get together in the summer and are really close and, like, having a great time. They're getting together to hear about the finances of their father passing and the estate distribution, because that's more of their tie together than seemingly anything else. And so I can deal with this for two episodes, the extent of like watching a film,
right?
But I don't know that I can suffer through multiple arcs of Eddie cleaning it up with Susie and then Freddie goofs it all up again because he did a little bit of coke. And so hopefully that's not where this goes, because I think that would work for a two episode arc, kind of like a film. But for eight episodes or however long this is, I'm going to need more. I don't even need Freddie to become a like really dynamic character. I just hope that like that way of setting up conflict is not the show's central source of tension. Now, they've already introduced sort of a broader villain, and so I have to assume that will end up being more of a, like, what creates conflict going forward. But I'm with you that I was.
You're talking about Bobby Glass, who is Susie Glass's father, right?
Yeah. Yes. Basically everything dealing with the, like, sort of who is going to end up owning this estate and this drug business. I'm hoping the Freddie Eddie thing is either done for, or they establish a new dynamic between the two of them. I'd be more interested in watching the two of them work together, and those personality types being so different, coming into conflict, but not because Freddie's just a fuck up that can't, you know, control himself for 5 minutes.
100% agreed. Do want to mention Giancarlo Esposito plays Stanley Johnston, who's this billionaire who's interested in the estate. Who knows how that's going to play out, but I have a feeling he's not going to be so patient later on in the show. I'm just guessing. I don't know anything. Stanley Johnson is basically Gus Fring if he never met Walter White. That's kind of what that character is, right?
I'm summarizing a much pithier like social media post, but it was something along the lines of a screenshot from the show with him in. It's like, is there ever been a better sign that some characters have fucked up than the presence of this guy in a show across the table from you? Which is just the kind of like, it's unfortunate that. I think he's a more talented, you know, actor than how he's sort of been typecast post Breaking Bad into sort of this, you know, supervillain that he now has across Star Wars, across here. But he's good at it. He's good at menace.
Indeed. And I just want to give a shout out to Guy Ritchie for hinging this entire plot on smartphone predictive text. I love this idea. The episode is titled Tackle Tommy Woo Woo. And it's like, why is this message here? Why did you write this? It's so cryptic and weird. And it's like the character Jethro says, I guess it was predictive text. That was the problem.
Well, I mean,
who among us has not had a predictive text snafu?
Exactly, 100%. But I was listening to an episode of your podcast, The Filmcast, as you were discussing, I forget what film it was, but essentially like how movies increasingly might have to set themselves as period pieces in like the 80s or 90s in order to avoid the way that cell phones destroy a lot of traditional plot devices for different films. And I thought, you know, I don't know that you can mine everything out of predictive text going awry, but I did think that was hints at like different ways you can approach the cell phone problem in films in a way that maybe suggest there are ways to get out of that and still set things in, you know, modern times. And you just have to be a little more creative about what can go wrong with a cell phone based on what it's good and isn't good at. So I thought that was a really neat solution to the problem.
Agreed. Smartphones can go wrong all the time. Curb Your Enthusiasm. There is a whole 5-minute scene of Larry David screaming at Siri this season, you know? So definitely you can use cell phones to create tension as well. They don't only need to diffuse it. All right. Overall, Patrick Klepek, I think we like the show. It's fun. It's not necessarily super serious. Like, it's not going to be a treatise on the London underworld and class disparity or anything like that. It's just like kind of have a blast watching bad people do bad things to each other. That's what it is. So
it's a good time. It is a definition of a good time show that goes down easy. And that's okay sometimes.
Yeah. And so we will plan to do a bonus episode talking about the end of the first season sometime in the next month. Still figuring out exactly how to cover these shows that drop all at once. Always open to your feedback at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let's get to our conversation about Shogun.
I have not told you my family name, but it is well known in Japan.
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about Shogun Episode 4, The Eightfold Fence. Overall, what did you think of this episode, Patrick Klepek?
swings in a lot of directions. Obviously ends in a really interesting place that sets up a lot of dominoes to fall for the future. But I liked a lot of the character development in this episode. I think it does both a great job, I think, providing exceptional depth to the characters that we know, moving certain characters off the stage to give more characters time to be characters. And yet, at the same time, really meaningfully advances the plot and the arc of the season in ways that had me hooting and hollering by the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way that I am like, now this is a show we can't watch, you know, like you and I can't cheat. We can't watch ahead of where we're at.
Yes.
But if I could, I might have done that this week after I saw the conclusion of this episode.
Bold
I
was just, admission that Patrick would
come on,
break
like the
decoding
way
TV protocol. So I thought this was a great episode. And honestly, you know, people have been comparing this to Game of Thrones. It's similar to Game of Thrones in that it creates this whole other world of these warring factions that you kind of get really engrossed in. But also, like, structurally, sometimes it's like Game of Thrones in the sense that, hey, it's a lot of people talking in rooms and then occasionally shocking violence. Like, that's kind of, and that is very Game of Thrones, right? It's kind of, like, oh, we're all kind of just chilling, talking, debating, and then shocking violence. And that's kind of, that is a very Game of Thrones feel. That's a feeling I got watching Game of Thrones episodes early on. And that's kind of what I got watching this episode as well. So let's talk about and spoil this entire episode of Shogun. I want to make a correction from last week. I had mentioned that he is given the Blackthorne is given the name of Hatamoto, but that is not a name. It is actually a title. According to an article about Shogun at Men's Health, Hatamoto is a real historical term which translates from Japanese to English as guardian of the flag, working as a bannerman or upper vassal to a samurai lord. A daimyo such as Toranaga would have a whole number of Hatamoto working under them, similar to officers working under a general, end quote. So Hatamoto is a new title for Blackthorne, and we should make that clear, and it becomes very clear in this episode. So there's a few big plot lines in this episode that are worth mentioning and discussing in detail. First of all, there's what happens with Toranaga. So it's winter in Ajiro. Lord Yabushige is coming into town with Toranaga, Lord of the Kanto. And Toranaga at that point tells Yabushige that he's resigned from the Council of Regents. Yabushige doesn't take this news well. He's starting to freak out about it. But he doesn't have much time to think about it because he's already gotten to their destination. And after saying some greetings to all the men, Toranaga surprises Yabushige by leaving and saying Yabushige has to work with his son to prep the men for battle. Couple things to mention about this whole sequence. One is, I mean, this whole episode, Yabushige is such an amazing character. He is so funny because he is clearly in a hell of his own making. And, yes. And he is like over it. He's over it. He's just like, I can't believe this is how it's all going to end for me.
This is how I'm going to die?
This is how I'm going to die? This is so, a dumbass. This is so dumb. This is so dumb the way I'm dying. It's just like hilarious that he is so put upon. At the same time, he has created a lot of his own problems, right? Like, and so seeing a character that's just completely over it in this scenario is just inherently very enjoyable. And throughout the episode, he just keeps getting bad news after bad news. Like, oh, wait, I'm babysitting your son now? Like, it just is hilarious to see his reactions to everything that's going on. The other thing I want to mention about this scene is it looked freaking incredible, this whole sequence. You're seeing hundreds of men dressed up in full regalia, and it doesn't look like they're, you know, I'm sure CG was used, but it doesn't look like it looks all very photorealistic, and it's just a testament to the production values of the show, where we have seen many expensive shows, Patrick Klepek, Ahsoka, and other shows that use Secret Invasion, that use that cost over $200 million to make and look way crappier than this show, right? This show looks incredible. And this sequence where they have all these hundreds of men lined up and they're all chanting and they're all, you know, it's just like, wow. Every episode, there's multiple times I'm in awe that this show exists. Anyway, Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on this opening sequence?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you at how visually striking it is, especially relative to how a lot of the show is probably of the same budget, caliber, production. But I also think what's going for this show is, you know, the two shows you just, I heard a cough and then like there were some other things mentioned. I don't think I mentioned anything. Weird. You know, someone write in, let me know if you heard anything. But it's, those are shows where your eyes drift, right? Because what is there to watch? You are often drifting between the attempt to dazzle you with the effects on screen, because the character work is really worth paying that much attention to. There's not much to grip onto. I think part of what works in this show's favor is, you know, exceptional work by teams handling the intermingling of physical objects, digital objects, how all that stuff is staged and set up. Like, I think that is all masterfully done, but also your eyes are just fixated on the performances, like these characters in front of you. And I think that allows them to then get away with more because you are just so centrally focused. Like, how do you take your eyes off Toranaga? You just don't. And so I think that all of that stuff contributes to the visual storytelling of the show and the scale that it's trying to depict. And I do think that was something that, like, Game of Thrones also was able to do at its best, was like, yes, there was a wonderful mixture at its best of mixing the physical and the digital. But when you have these incredible eye fixating performances, you're just drawn to look at that and forgive less because you're not fixated on everything that's surrounding. Forgive more. Yes. To forgive more because you're not fixated on what's around them. Whereas in some of these other shows, you're kind of just dancing all over the screen and it makes bad stuff look worse. And so in a show where you have good stuff that already looks good, it looks even better when you're so focused on the singular performances at the center of it.
Indeed. Let's talk about some of the stuff that happens with Blackthorn and Mariko and Fuji this episode. With Blackthorn's new title of Hatamoto comes new spiffy living quarters and a consort, Fuji-sama, the woman whose husband and baby were killed for honor purposes in an earlier episode. Mariko explains that it will take 6 months to train the men, and Blackthorn does not take any of this well because he basically interprets it as another prison sentence. The next day, there is tension as Blackthorn is escorted to the training grounds but doesn't want to surrender his guns. Fuji intervenes and wins respect from all parties. I actually really, appreciate how the Blackthorn and Fuji relationship is developing. She kind of steps in and is a real badass in that scene. but it's just such an interesting dynamic where she's obviously had this unimaginable tragedy that she's had to endure. And then needs to work for Blackthorn, which is probably one of the worst jobs anyone could possibly have, right? No one wants that, but then kind of is still showing up, and there's some kind of nobility in that I think we're witnessing that character so far. Who knows where the Blackthorn Fuji relationship is going to evolve to, and how Blackthorn will evolve. Like, I don't know, but so far I'm really kind of loving that dynamic, and it's a really interesting dynamic that we don't get to see very often on TV or in film. Like, it's using this time period to show this dynamic that's very unique. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on these scenes with Blackthorn and Fuji?
Well, I just love, especially contrasted against a scene we get later that we'll get into when Blackthorn presents, a weapon, like a gun, and the way she recoils at, like, this disgusting, like, what would I do with this contraption? And yet, like, you forget that, like, scenes before, she seemed like the ultimate badass with that, like, I'm not even sure if she knew how to fire that weapon when she aimed it at that guy, but she did so utterly convincingly that it didn't matter, and everyone backed off, the situation was able to resolve. So I think that speaks to her ability to improvise, and I have to suspect that improvisational ability will be something we see more of going forward.
My interpretation was kind of, this is a very crude weapon compared, this is not a weapon for a more civilized age, like a sword.
Yeah, so there's no honor in a gun.
Right, exactly. But it's fair enough. What a touching scene between the two of them where they kind of, they can't speak each other's language, but they can kind of connect or attempt to connect in some way. I thought that was lovely. Anyway. On the field of battle, Yabushige explains that his men don't need to learn about guns and muskets because the Portuguese already introduced them to those weapons 50 years ago. But they do need to learn about battlefield tactics. It becomes clear real quick that Blackthorn doesn't know shit about any of that, but he does understand naval battle tactics. So that's where he changes the subject to. And he starts training Yabushige's men on how to use cannons and fire them with a precision that they'd never witnessed before. So, funny scene because it's like Blackthorn's that guy that gets up in front of the class for the day of the presentation and hasn't prepared at all. Like he hasn't even made up a convincing bullshit story of how tactics are used. So anyway, I thought that was highly amusing. And again, the show using Mariko translating between them as this whole other layer that's going on in the conversation between the characters. That I particularly appreciated. Patrick, any thoughts on the sequence? Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's I just like watching the show increasingly put him in situations where, all right, buddy, let's make those wheels turn.
How are you going to get out of dying today? Basically, right?
There's the famous tweet about Trump that's like,
can't wait to see like old Donnie Trump wriggle his way out of this one. Like wriggles his way out of it easily. And there's a quality to that with Blackthorne. It's like, ha, buddy, what are the tactics? Huh? What are the tactics? And then he figures out the canon solution. And a lot of this show is him being put in increasingly odd situations that he doesn't have a good answer to. And he comes up with one. He pulls a rabbit out of the hat and over again. And, you know, that's being paired with at least what we can see so far, what I take to be like a genuine like emotion react. Like we do see a character developing. It is not just a clown that is coming up with solutions to the predicament that they're in. We'll see where all that ends up landing. But I enjoy that is a reoccurring bit of the show is, what's old Blackthorne gonna do this time now that he's been asked to do something that he's unqualified for?
Indeed. Highly amusing, but still impressive that he's able to get out of this situation. So,
It was a good solution, too. It was a smart one.
Later, Blackthorne and Fuji reconcile with Blackthorne giving Fuji a weapon, Fuji giving Blackthorne some swords. Mariko and Blackthorne have several heart-to-hearts throughout this episode, with Mariko discussing their philosophy on life and how brutal and short it is in Japan, and also revealing that she has a different mission as yet undisclosed. Some great writing in this episode. Mariko going on a few monologues. You know, she talks about death is in our air and our sea and earth. It can come for us at any moment. We live and we die. We control nothing beyond that, end quote. And you are reminded that Japan is a country that has had a lot of tragedy when it comes to natural disasters and man-made disasters and man-made attacks and so on and so forth. And that was obviously something that was true even back hundreds of years ago. I did think that was a sobering reminder there. Also, Mariko says later on in the episode that, quote, many, many years ago, a great injustice stole everything from me. For a long time, I've been unable to seek resolution for what happened. But recently, Toranaga offered me a way, end quote. So I have a feeling she's going to be pretty critical to the plot later on. You know, not a book reader expert, but I have a feeling that that's going to be like, we're going to find out at the end of the day. Like, that was the whole game all along, is what Mariko's secret mission is.
Well, yeah, once when you're getting vague and foreboding flashbacks like, you're not showing me the whole context of this scene. Wonder if that'll be important later on.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see that there's a little more increased depth to the character. Like, that's a lot of what this episode accomplishes in general, is I think really rounding out how deep these characters are going to go, and her in particular.
Later that night, Blackthorne is visited by a woman who sleeps with him. The next day, Mariko claims that it was a courtesan that was sent to his room. But was it? Question mark. Patrick Klepek, I have watched the tape several times, and I have read writing on it. A lot of people seem to think it was Mariko. And I'm going to put this out there. I think it was meant to be ambiguous. The lighting is such that her hair is a little bit, the hair of the person who sleeps with him is a little bit different than Mariko's hair, like a little bit. But I think we are meant to think it was Mariko, but that it is ambiguous enough that you could interpret it either way. Either way, assuming it was Mariko, she would tell that story anyway, because it would be wildly inappropriate for her to sleep with him. So that would be the kind of the cover story they use. And then she kind of gives Fuji a look of like, hey, yeah, we both thought it'd be a great idea. And Fuji's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You know? But what was your interpretation of what actually went down there?
Well, it's funny because in the scene before, when Blackthorne is, you know, out taking a bath, he's not got clothes on. Mariko shows up and I'm like, no, I didn't want this arc to occur. I was like, I was actually whispering to myself, don't have sex. Because I'm just you know, again, this story is so thoughtfully crafted.
It's a very, you know, warmed over trope of, you know, white dude parachutes into foreign land and you know, women fall in love with it. That is, has, we've seen it many times, you know, Avatar and The Last Samurai and Dances with Wolves. Like, we've seen it many times.
This is based on an old text, right? Like, it would not be shocking for it to have...
Right, but they've also made changes, so it's like, who knows?
Correct.
Who knows,
right? I have no idea. And I'm doing my best to not read ahead on, like, you know, or have comparative analysis that's incorporating the book and the miniseries, so I can try and take it as it is. But however that, whatever the truth of the matter is, and I assume that we'll get a sense of that one way or the, like, I don't think, if Mariko is choosing to lay with him, that will continue to be, like, that will be some point that is brought up later. If the alternative is possible, in which, you know, she truly did set something up for him, she's calculating. Like, a huge part of what happens in this episode is she is not impulsive. She is not reactionary. She is thinking multiple steps ahead to accomplish whatever is going to satisfy this, like, this tension in her heart, this revenge she is seeking, this resolution she is seeking. And so, you know, I guess that's the one thing I take away from it is if that was her, then she's got her reasons. And I'm interested to see what those reasons are. And I'm hopeful that it's again, there's more nuance to it than just, like, the sexy white guy showed up to a foreign land and then she had sex with him. This show's too smart for that. So I'm willing to go either way, but at this point, that's fair.
But yeah, but also, like, did you think that was actually her that had sex with him?
That's what I thought in the moment. I 100% thought it was her. Like, I think the show is doing that on like, they just went to a sexy time pond and like had a close moment. And then, like, he's asleep and a woman comes. I mean, but then it's part of a punchline as well, right? Like, the ambiguous nature of it makes for a very funny exchange the next morning. And so, you know, it's both humorous and intimate and interesting. And I think we will get an answer to it one way or the other.
Yeah,
in short,
I think you're probably right about that, but it is, I sound like a pervert, but it's like, I literally just went back and it is expert the way they lit that scene, because it just leaves just enough ambiguity for you to maybe think it wasn't her. Like, there's, I do think it is, there is enough ambiguity for you to legitimately believe it was not her.
Yes,
but yeah, anyway, so we'll see how that relationship plays out. But I was like wow, it's very rare to see something like that where you watch a thing and then you're like, oh, I know that's character A having sex with character B. And then the next morning it's like, actually, what if it wasn't? You know, I'm like, what? Like, and then I had to go back and rewind. Okay, anyway. It wasn't that graphic, okay? It wasn't that graphic. So it's not like I was rewatching that for that reason. Anyway, let's talk about what happens with Yabushige in this episode. Yabushige is desperately trying to play both sides and failing miserably. And at the end of the episode, Ishido's men arrive to basically ask, hey, man, what's the deal with you? You were supposed to be on our side, right? Yabushige insists that Ishido's men stay the night so they can see what Toranaga's men are working on. Meanwhile, Toranaga's son, Yoshii, is unhappy with what he perceives to be Yabushige's treachery. We also, by the way, get a separate scene of, I think it's Omi, Yabushige's nephew, getting Lady Macbeth by the woman that he is sleeping with. So,
yeah.
Anyway. The next morning, when Ishido's men are there to view a demonstration of the cannons, Yoshii turns the cannons on them in a spectacular display of gruesome violence. The episode ends with Mariko realizing in horror that war has now begun between the clans. This scene is absolutely incredible.
It's so freaking good.
It's so good. Because you have, not since Ridley Scott's Napoleon, have you seen what cannonballs can do to human and horse flesh, like completely dismantle them. It is amazing. It's an amazing moment. It's amazingly depicted. It is frighteningly plausible how it looks. And it's also surprising. I mean, you kind of see it coming. You kind of know that Yoshii is going to do something because he's clearly unhappy with how he's being treated. And he's thinking to himself, hey, I got to show that I am also, I also have the heart of a leader, and I'm going to do that by starting a war, apparently. Anyway, any other thoughts on this sequence, Patrick Lepik?
No, it's not surprising, but it's also not completely telegraphed. It is not as though it's the kind of scene that as it opens, you're like, now I am waiting for these men to die.
Right.
But it dawns upon you pretty quickly that
things are amiss. Something is going to happen. And the way it, like, you know, they get hit once and it sort of just cuts away. And then when they get hit again, that's when the show really unleashes sort of the graphic nature of the violence. And it really
and
sells
a scene
like,
where Josen, the guy, is his
oh
like
my god,
dismembered, and he's still alive on the ground, and it's like wow, they had to mock up a whole version of his dead body, like his dismembered body, just so that actor could kind of be acting that scene. Yeah,
the effects are tremendous. Like 100% believe that man lost most of his body parts, except for the ones that let him still talk and give a monologue at the end to Toranaga's son. But it's shocking in a really like entertaining way. It's shocking in a really thoughtful way. Again, this is a show that is really thoughtful about it, often in its depictions of violence. Like it's here is more in line with what we saw in the first two episodes of the show, where when violence does occur, it is quick, it is brutal, it is upsetting, and it's to a point. And I think one of the problems that you and I had with the third episode was here's a lot of, I don't know, sword fighting, you know, esque combat that, you know, the choreography was fine, like the filming of it was fine, but it felt like we were mostly just wasting time to get to the next scene. And I think this show is at its best when it is similar to Game of Thrones. It is using violence to make a story point. And I think not that I am sure there are big battles to come in Shogun. Like there is not a chance that we aren't going to get a castle siege. There's not a chance that we're not going to get, you know, armies charging at each other from across the way.
Yeah.
But I find the show to be at its best when it's using all that to be a point, as opposed to, look how epic we are. Like, look at what we staged. And here is the show at its best. And it just had me, on the edge of my seat to find out. Toranaga is, I don't think he's going to be happy, David. I don't think he's going to be psyched about this development.
Yeah, it's a well-taken point, Patrick Klepek, about how the show, when it deploys violence strategically, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it, there's, you know, one or two moments of violence in this episode, and that is way more interesting in general than having a whole episode of decent set pieces. That's which is kind of what last episode was.
Yeah.
I do just want to say it is really funny to watch Yabushige trying to play both sides literally while everyone is kind of in the same space.
I'm betraying his father.
yeah. I would never. The idea that I would even betray your father is insulting to even contemplate. and like, meanwhile, he's literally doing it. Like, he's like, by the way, we're betraying him. Okay, so FYI,
do not kill this guy. This man needs to be here to the final episode. I have pivoted. Like, I need my clown boy to be here to the bitter end. Like, he is such a fun character, and like, I love the idea of him just spinning all these plates, but they're constantly breaking. And like, he's, oh no. It's so good.
The problem is he hasn't really, like, until this episode, he didn't really choose a side, right? I think he was still playing both sides, but he didn't really
chosen as opposed to him choosing.
right. I mean, now it is chosen, right? But like, as of this episode, he wasn't fully on board with Toranaga.
Yeah.
Nor do I think was he fully on board with Ishido at that point. And now he has to kind of throw his lot in with Toranaga. I feel like he's probably going to betray Toranaga at some point. That's probably in the mix. But that's his problem. Is like people who don't choose a side, who play both sides, they are often the people looked upon in the least favorable light in these types of shows, and they usually guess their just desserts. But I just love that it's a character who like understands the absurdity of his situation, right? It's he's not like Littlefinger. You know, Littlefinger was always like extremely serious about his job, and Yabushige is like, wow, like, I guess I'm screwed, and it's really dumb the way that I'm screwed, you know. And
it's nice to have a funny character in like that's rare in a show that is otherwise so deathly serious. And this show is very serious and somber. And now, granted, you know, one could argue Cosmo Jarvis's accent is itself a human. Did you see like the quote where he was like,
it was so much worse. The accent I pitched was so much worse, and the directors told me to tone it down and like release the Jarvis cut. Like, give me give me what he claims to be the exaggerated version of that accent and that approach. I need to hear it.
Indeed. All right, Patrick Klepek, any closing thoughts on this episode of Shogun? Of course, we'll be covering the next episode on next week's episode of the podcast.
I just want to see Torinaga's reaction. I am sure that's going to happen early in the next episode. And, I'm just excited for him to get back because things are currently a shit show, David, even if they do have the cannons.
Indeed. All right. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Decoding TV. Patrick Klepek, you want to hit people up with where they can find more of your work in the meantime?
Yes, you can hear me yapping about video games over at remapradio.com. And you can follow my newsletter about parenting and gaming called Crossplay at crossplay.news.
And check out all of our online presences. We're posting videos every week at Decoding TV on youtube.com/decodingTV. And also at TikTok and Instagram on Decoding TV. I actually think there's people whose primary experience of this podcast is through the YouTube channel at youtube.com/@decodingTV. So if you are among them, welcome. And I hope you continue watching us over there. But anyway, next week, it's going to be Manhunt. It's going to be Shogun Episode 5. Patrick Klepek will not be here, but he'll be back the following week. We'll have someone subbing in for him in the meantime, but it's going to be a great time. We'll see you later.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.